First, some of you don't know, Fritz Norst did. Probably you all do. I want to say that the reason I came to Holden was because of Fritz Norst did. And because it was the first year, I think, they had a family program. And I'd known Fritz before, and Fritz is more than a brother to me. Fritz is more than a brother to me. The debt I owe him is probably more than one man can owe another. We have great times together, even when we're together on the program. In fact, this wasn't scheduled, but Fritz, I knew he was coming, and he knew I was here, so he says, we'll have a program together. So that's what you're having tonight. The story goes like this. In a far-off land a long time ago, there was a prince. And the revolutionaries were trying to take over the kingdom. And the prince had to escape to save his life. And he sought refuge in a peasant's cottage. And he didn't tell the peasant who he was. The peasant agreed to hide him. And he put him under a very heavy bed that it took several people to move. And it wasn't long before the revolutionaries came and beat down the door and searched his whole house. And because the bed was so hard to move, instead of trying to move it and look under it, they took their swords and jammed through the mattress to the floor. Not getting any response, they had searched the place and left. When they were safely out of sight, the peasant and his family extricated the prince, who was really shaken, but untouched, miraculously. And it's then when the prince told him who he was. And he says, because you have saved my life, I will grant you three wishes. And the peasant, being very poor and in a kind of broken down house, said, well, my house really needs fixing up, and I'm very poor, and I'd really appreciate that. And the princess said, it will be granted, but you're a fool for not asking for more. And so you have two more wishes. So the second wish of the peasant was, he says, I raise a few things on my farm, my little plot of ground, and I sell it in the village. And right next door to me is my neighbor who sells, produces the same thing and sells. He says, if we had booths further apart, we could probably do better. And the prince says, you're stupid for asking such a small thing. Now you have the third wish. Why don't you make it a good one? But the peasant couldn't contain himself. And he says, what were you thinking about when you were laying under that bed and they were poking the swords through? And the prince was infuriated. And he says, how dare you ask the emotions of royalty? For that you will be taken to prison and beheaded in the morning. And so they hauled away the shaken peasant who was crying. He probably cried all night. At 7 o'clock in the morning, they took him out. And the fellow with the gallows there with the black hood on. And they called one, two, and before they could say three, a messenger from the prince came riding in on a horse and says, stop the proceedings. The prince has forgiven the peasant. And he has this message for him, which he read. You now have the answer to your third wish. You see, the story here is that unless you've experienced it, you don't really know how it is. Huh? And tonight, Fritz and I are going to discuss with you a heavy. We have both lost big. We both lost daughters before before the shadow of their life touched noon. And this is a heavy. It's something from which, of course, you who have experienced similarly know you never recover from. We have also lost heavily on animals. And so we're going to talk about grief and severe distress following great loss. And Fritz is first.
Leo and I have been coming here for 63 years. Not quite. That's what I thought he was pulling when he said that we had come in 1920 something, and that would make it about 63 years. Now, we've been coming since 1963, and that's 23 years ago. And it wouldn't seem like coming to Holden for me, and the times I get up here when Leo isn't here, it seems like I'm not quite here. Because we've had a relationship down through these years that keeps growing and getting deeper. And when you can know someone and love someone for years like that, and then have shared what we have been privileged to share and what we have sometimes been forced to share against our will and against our wishes, it has formed a bond that is rare indeed. It may surprise you a little bit that we want to put human grief and grief in animals together at one time, but it fits in a little bit with the theme that you've been hearing, I understand, the last few days, and which will be coming on some more next Monday, when we'll be talking more about the unity of things and in this creation. And animals have been a very important part of it, and you've been hearing a great deal about animals from the expert on human-animal bond. And I'd like to start tonight just with an anecdote. More than that, a bit of suffering out of my own life when my dog Bo died. Bo was a clown. He was a German short-haired pointer, if you know what that is. They're good hunting dogs. But this guy was a kind of a palooka. He was always getting into difficulty. I remember the day I brought him home, he was a year old when I got him. It was probably a mistake, wasn't it?
Bringing him home was a mistake.
And I told my wife, who doesn't like dogs anyway, that we now had a dog. And she thought she ought to have been consulted about this, and I knew that she should not have been, because if there had been a consultation, we wouldn't have had the dog. It's very simple. But she put up with the dog, and still does. We still have one. All these years, she keeps putting up with dogs, but never votes in favor of getting one. But I brought Bo home, and right after we brought the dog home, she said, "Well, you remember now, we're going out to dinner. What are we going to do with that dog?" So I said, "Well, all we got to do is let him go in the house. It's housebroken, and he's fine. We just let him be here. He's got a good, kind, gentle dog." When we got home, my wife's new winter coat with a fur collar on it was right in front of the door, like I've been laid there for a doormat. And hung the coat up without saying anything. Gertrude didn't say anything. I went upstairs in a little while and went to bed. Gertrude didn't say anything. And to this day, it's never been mentioned in our house. Neither one of us would dare bring up the topic of that coat. But Bo was a character. Now that's the way he entered our house with such indiscretion. But he, for instance, learned to like. In fact, he had a passion for Philadelphia cream cheese smeared over with a bunch of cocktail sauce and shrimp. You know, that you use for kind of a dip. And we couldn't get it out on the coffee table without that dog coming out of nowhere and going, and the whole thing was gone, you know, half a pound at a time. Again, Gertrude lived through it, or let me live through it. And then we moved out here, and we came to Holden Village. We came up the lake the night, or the day we came up in a little boat that I had, and I towed all the way out from Chicago. And we came up the hill, and I thought, what a wonderful place for my dog. He can run and run and run, and he doesn't have to be in the house and bothering Gertrude all the time. Great place. The dog had different ideas. We went in for this, for the Vespers, like tonight, huh? And the dog was left outside. And then they started to introduce people. And then they came down and said, then we have Fritz and Gertrude Norsted who are joining us in the village. And just then, up in the balcony, there's a loud woof. My dog had discovered us. He'd come inside looking for us, gotten up in the balcony, and when we stood up, he spotted us and let out a yelp. Then he proceeded to endear himself to the community by rolling in the garbage up here and then coming around wanting to be petted. And he also went fishing with all the guys who went fishing. Every time the fellows go up with their finely tied flies and lay them out in the beaver ponds that are up the creek here a ways, Bo would see those things, and being a retriever, he did what retrievers ought to do. And into the water he went to try to retrieve the fly. So I almost lost my relationship with the village immediately. But at any rate, there came a time when Bo wasn't feeling very well, and he was trying to cough up something and couldn't get it coughed up. So he was in great distress. And the next day, I noticed that his belly was distending. I took him to the veterinarian, and he took a look at him and said, he's got a lot of blood in there. I don't know what's doing it. So I said, well, could the coughing be doing anything, or the hacking that he's been doing? He's been trying to get something up. Well, it could, so he can operate. And he operated, and he found that the dog had a bunch of steak bones in him. Why don't you people spread the word that bones aren't good for dogs?
I tell it, but these owners never listen.
Oh. But at any rate, I, you know, let the dog have these steak bones, and he literally was killing himself. And he had torn his spleen loose and flipped it around. And then this had strangulated and burst and blood. He got him sewed up, but about 2 weeks later, he broke it loose. I came home, I'd been gone, and I came home, and here was this dog. Oh, I should tell you first, the dog fishes, or did fish. He'd go down by the stream, by the river, in front of our house. And while we were building the house, I'd be up on the roof with my son, putting on shakes, and we'd look down, and there was a pool right below the house, and here the dog would be standing, looking, pointing into the water. And I began to think that this was Oedipus, you know. This guy was in love with his image or something, and, or whatever. But at any rate, we were a little disturbed by this because the dog was just acting dumb, just stupid, and I didn't like that. Until one day, two of the guys went down to swim while the dog was down there pointing at his nose in the water, and he sticks his head underneath the water and comes up with a trout. And after that, he caught about four or five trout while people were down there, and we watched him catch trout. Unfortunately, he got sick. This thing I want to tell about, just before I had been able to teach him to retrieve the fish, and then I would never have had to go fishing in my whole life again. You know, if I could have had the dog go down there, we'd never had to go up to Donkey Lake again.
Yes, we would, but
we could let the dog handle it for us. But the second time, the dog, when I was coming home and the dog was obviously sick when I reached him. I couldn't find him at first. Looked all around the yard for him, couldn't find him because we'd left him outside. And when I made one last search, went down near where I have a photographic darkroom, and the only person who ever goes near that place or can get into it with me. And there by the door of that thing was Bo, thinking that maybe I was in the darkroom. So I opened the door and he struggled to his feet and walked in, and then we went into the darkroom because I could see that he was in great distress, and I decided that he was not going back for more surgery. There comes a time when I didn't think I could justify doing that again. Either putting the dog through that or putting my pocketbook through it again. And it was a terrible thing to sit there wondering, should I call the doctor or not call the doctor? What should I do? And the dog then crawled in under the kind of a knee hole under the enlarging table that I have and curled up in that little den. And then he came out. He whined a little bit, struggled to his feet after about an hour, and I sat down on the floor right alongside of this place and watching him, suffering with him a little bit at least. And then Bo turned around and struggled, and you could tell that it was costing him a great deal in terms of pain. He walked over and put his head in my lap and then died. And so there was a time of some hugging. I suppose that anybody had looked in from the outside, they might have thought, what a foolish thing, a guy sitting there hugging a dead dog. But the dog was more than what is meant by just a dead dog. Because here was relationship, here was love, from an animal to a human, from a human to an animal. That was, in essence, no different than the human love. It called that, sitting down there on that basement floor, holding this dog, being grateful for all the good times we'd had, but now just terribly sorry that he was taken away. But somehow or another, it seemed to tap in me other griefs. The tears that were shed in those moments were not only the tears out of that occasion, but they were also the tears out of the night that Susan died. I guess maybe there were more tears when Bo died than when Susan died, but for other reasons, no. Susan's had been a long, drawn-out cancer. And there have been lots of tears since that time, as my friend knows. He has shared some of mine, as I've shared some of his. The grief that I felt when Bo died made it possible to grieve again, and perhaps in a somewhat freer way than the grief that I experienced when Susan died or when my youngest brother died way too early, or when my grandfather died, which I, the first time I'd ever seen death was when he died, called me in to sit by him when he was dying. One grief became a sort of a symbol of all suffering and all pain of that nature. And in this case, it was the dog that gave the opportunity to express it again. Not perhaps in the ugly way that it might sound upon telling it, but with something of decency and of beauty in it at the same time. A sort of a rightness about crying because Bo was gone. Because he was one fine guy. Rambunctious, a palooka, sure. But he could sense my moods before I knew them myself. If I walked in the house feeling upset or depressed, that dog never came and just jumped up at me like he usually did. He kind of tiptoed over and laid down alongside of me. Or if I came home, you know, feeling great, then the dog was whirling around in circles and jumping all over the place. Had that wonderful sense that animals can have, picking up moods that probably as humans becomes in many circumstances anyway, a little bit more difficult because we let words get in between something else that can be communicated. We try to explain that I'm depressed today or I had a lousy day at the office or something, and somehow or another some of the feelings that can be communicated without the words, just through the body language and through the expressions on our faces, and through our quietness or through our loquaciousness get expressed. Now, Bo has a successor, and the successor's name is Borghild. And she is a great animal. She was my son's dog, really. And my son called me one day and said, "Dad, Borgie's going to have puppies, and I don't think my one-room apartment in Chicago is a proper place for a bunch of puppies. So I'm going to send her out." So I said, "Okay, when?" "Well, maybe this afternoon or tomorrow morning I'll get her on the plane. I'll call you just as soon as I get her onto the plane." So I got a call a few hours later saying, "She's on the plane. Will you please go over to Seattle to pick up the dog?"
From Leavenworth.
So I dragged over there to meet this airplane to get this dog off the airplane, and sure enough, here comes Borgie. I'd seen her when she was a little puppy, but I didn't pay too much attention to her. She was my son's dog, and I had my dog, and you know how that goes. I called Dave back and said, "I forgot to ask you, when is she going to have the puppies?" And he said, "Well, any day." And she kind of looked. So I took her right down to our veterinarian, one of your graduates, a fine, fine, fine guy. And he said, "Well, she is going to have puppies, and certainly any day now." And he said, "Furthermore, I think I can tell you how many." And he's touching around and very gently probing. And he said, "You're going to have three puppies." Well, that nice sized family, so I thanked him and took the dog home. And about 10 days later, 10 days later, there were 12 puppies in my basement. 12. It shows how you teach people over there.
We teach them to tell people how many they can stand to have. You're gonna blow your mind.
That's the way teachers get out of explain all of these things. But then, the birth of those puppies was something, because two of them were too many. For one thing, the plumbing is in only for 10. Is that right?
Maybe.
Maybe, what do you mean, maybe?
Very simple.
Well, she had 10.
All right.
All right. I thought that was true at all. But at any rate, so two of them wouldn't have had room anyway. But they were so small, they must have been at the wrong end of the... It was the first one born and the last one born. Does that mean anything?
Yeah.
Nutritionally?
First and last.
But at any rate, here were these two tiny, tiny little things. So we'd hold them in our hands with an eyedropper, you know, put them on a heating pad to try to keep them warm. But they were just digesting their own protein, I suppose. And pretty soon they shriveled away after about 2 days.
Well, Gertrude was doing this.
I didn't do much of it. But, she doesn't like dogs. You should have seen her with those little things. You should have seen her cry when the first one died. I think she drowned it, really, because she was squirting that milk in there and the puppy couldn't swallow it. No, she was very tenderly trying to keep this little puppy alive. And then she shed some tears, and I didn't think she would ever do that over a dog. And I wasn't that too grieved by the loss of that little puppy. Then the second one had to be disposed of because there was no sense in putting it through any more of this suffering.
But tell about how the dog was concerned when you took him.
Oh, each time we took the puppies away to take them upstairs to feed them, the mother dog down there with left with the 10 puppies became very agitated, very agitated. And whine and bark from down there, and normally she was just as quiet as could be. But she was very much disturbed when we took those puppies, the little ones away, missing 2 out of 12. You'd think she'd just been grateful to us for relieving her of that. Then the two were gone, and right away we saw a change in the personality of Borghild, because she immediately started to cry a great deal. She didn't eat very much, and constantly wanting to get out, away from her puppies. Then she would run upstairs, come to the door, want to come in, and run right over to where we used to sit, holding these little ones. So she missed the two tiny little puppies that had been with her only 48 hours or so.
But she'd come out, you had her up there each day to see where they were.
See where they were, so she knew where they had been. About 6 months ago, I decided that the one puppy that we had kept, another bull, another dog with the same kind of personality, rambunctious, full steam ahead, great dog, but hard to handle in a house, but that maybe he would be better off if, and I would be better off if,
and Gertrude too.
Yeah, if we had only one dog in the house. And so I gave away the one that would be hardest to handle and hardest to have around the house, and that was Bo. That was really my dog. And I felt some kind of a special virtuous hero to give up my dog and keep the other one. Immediately after doing that, we noticed that Borghild went into a deep depression. The depression lasted from last November until about 2 months ago, when she started to act somewhat more normally, but it was only 4 or 5 days ago that she came all the way back. She wasn't eating well during all of this time. She wouldn't stand up to welcome me when I came through the door. She was she'd sit around there with her eyes wide open, but we'd hear little whimpering cries from her throughout that whole period. Whole lot of it at first, and then only once in a while in the later weeks and months now. I knew that she was over her grieving, however, last Saturday morning, when I took her out in the morning and took her down the walk, down the lane there for her walk. And all of a sudden, she came running back to me and ran past me like a freight train, went down that way about 100 yards, put on the brakes, the dust flew, she came running past, jumped past me so she was in the air when she went by, went down that way 100 yards, made a fast turn, skidding the dust and the leaves all over, and did that about 6 or 8 times. And then came and stood in front of me and wagged her tail. Joy had been given back to her again. Again, I think the animal was serving me as an invitation to joy, because there was no way I could escape joining her in this fun. There's just no way. I had to respond to it by picking up a mood from her. And again, I suppose I certainly didn't think of it at the time that there was another dimension to that, that maybe this was also contacting. Just as in the death of Bo, I was put in contact with all the griefs I've ever known, and maybe some of the griefs of others. This joy, I suppose, put me in contact with just joy. kinds of things that Leo can, and I'm sure has told you about, I hope, and if he hasn't, he better get at it, what happens to people in situations of loneliness, for instance, or of ill health, when they have a puppy or a kitten, a pet, is just remarkable, and things that we ought to be tuning in on and catching up on. I suppose that it's possible to replicate these in different kinds of relationships. Surely it must be. But the dog and the cat and other pets are such a convenient way, undemanding, forgiving, because they never find you guilty, huh? They don't know a record. Don't ask a record. There was a woman that lived next door to us who was an old lady and was dying, and we had to take her to a hospital first and then a rest home. And we would walk in the room, and she would smile a bit and welcome us and thank us for coming. And then one day we thought, there ought to be a way to get her little dog in that she'd had for 10 years or 12 years. And she thought a great deal of this was, right next to our house. And we talked to the hospital personnel, and they said, well, if you're careful and discreet about this and carry the dog through the corridors and carry the dog into the room, fine. You should have seen that lady who had said only a few words to any visitor that ever came in the room, including her son, through the time that she was ill. You should have seen her brighten up when this little poodle was brought in and put on her bed and ran up there to lick her face. There was a relationship between the two that was so strong and so close that you wondered if she could live without that dog. Well, she died, and then the dog died. Now, again, these are just some that I have bumped into. The stories that Leo has been telling me down through these last few years, when he's become so deeply involved with pets and therapy, should get much more attention from humans, because there's much more profound significance. Heart attacks are, repeat heart attacks are less common among those who pet a dog than those who don't pet a dog. Now, that ought to mean something to us. But I suppose it comes by way of dispelling some of the loneliness that is so much a part of human existence today, and always has been, but maybe more so today in this world where we pass each other instead of sitting down with each other, where we sort of rub shoulders, but we don't hug, where we may go through just the necessities of some language and communication without just really sitting down and knowing and being known. Well, that's just a bit of human grief, of animal grief. Leo and I have shared common experience, as so many of you have with us, of losing loved ones on the human level. Why don't you start with that one?
Okay. I want to say one thing. I was reminded of it. On grieving over an animal and a person, one of my closest associates in the College of Veterinary Medicine is a girl I'm helping a bit. She never knew her father, and her mother died when she was 12. She helped nurse her mother from the age of 10 to 12. Her mother had diabetes. Died at 12. So she sort of prepared her for her death. And at this time, she'd gotten a dog. And 9 years later, the dog got out and was run over by a car. Now, I found this all out because she took my course in Reverence for Life, and she chose to do the section on grief in people and animals. And she was almost embarrassed to say, to tell the class as she went through the stages of grief that one manifests. And was embarrassed to say that her grief was greater with the loss of the dog than over her mother. And she was sort of embarrassed to tell us this. But it was real, and you have to consider the age in which her mother died and her preparation for it, where the dog was the only thing she had left, really, and had had it 9 years, and at a critical time was suddenly killed. And the suddenness sometimes is very devastating.
Let the psychologist side of me speak for a minute. We see sometimes in human grief that a person may grieve over a minor loss, but grieve greatly when they hadn't grieved over a big loss. And the reason for it is rather obvious in many of the cases, where the grieving itself is too threatening in the primary loss, the big loss. And then a secondary loss or a smaller loss.
Yeah, it all comes out.
They're able because it doesn't threaten them so much. I had a woman who was sent to me by a psychiatrist for extensive and long-term counseling because she was grieving, and she cried and cried every time she came. She was crying, and she was crying at home all the time over the loss of a distant relative whom she had never met. Mm-hmm. Well, there had to be something back of it. Then we found that she had, as an unwed mother 30 years before, 40 years before, had lost a baby that she had had for about 6 or 8 months, and that baby had died. But she didn't dare grieve over that one for a variety of reasons. But she could grieve over this distant relative, because that was safe. And perhaps when I mentioned grieving over Bo that way, I was saying a little bit of this, that it was possible to open up the depths of grief over the dog when it hadn't been entirely possible to do that with Sue because it was too big.
Yeah.
It was too big.
I'll relate to begin with the in one of our Carnes letters from the year before she died, she'd been over at Cameroon for over a year. She says, "I'm feeling frazzled and worn, physically, emotionally, and mentally. One of my students from last year died yesterday after a sudden illness. We flew school flags at half-mast today. The students were subdued, and all the teachers that taught here last year were gloomy all day. I didn't see many smiles. My cheeks feel chapped from the tears that have been rolling down them since I heard the news last night. He was such an active, mischief-making student that I argued and struggled with all year long. I had to push him to his desk and hold him in his chair at least once a class period. So I grew attached to him in spite of myself. You know how it is, the troublemakers are often so intelligent and charming that they're the students you love the most. So I'm feeling sad. I remember reading one of his themes last year. I assigned them to write about the last time they were in their village. Well, Mabala's theme was so touching that it made me cry. In it, he said that when he arrived, his sister saw him coming in the distance and he came running. His grandmother cooked him all his favorite dishes. And when the vacation was over, they all went with him to the auto car and cried as they said goodbye because they loved him so much. And he cried too because he had to leave the people he loved in order to go to school. Well, they're crying now too. He'll never be back to the village again. And as I was walking home from school today, basking in the sunshine, I couldn't help crying out to God how terrible that was, that Mabala would never feel the sunshine on his cheeks again. The chapel service today was short but powerful. Chaplain said that since Mabala had loved Jesus, he's happy now that we are, though we are sad because we miss him, and that we don't have to fear death because Jesus has conquered it, and that salvation is there now for any of us who ask for it. There's nothing like death right in front of you to make you receptive of a message like that. Maybe that's why sometimes life in America gets so trivial and banal, because we aren't close to death the way we are here. So we can ignore questions that concern the meaning of life and death. I've been thinking of staying another year, but I'm not sure now. Kids are always dying here, and I can't bear to go through it again. Almost every year a student dies at the college. Last year it was a student I didn't know, so it didn't hit me. Now I know almost all of them and want to think of them having bright futures here on earth. I don't want to mourn anymore. I'd rather go home where death is hidden away and the people are strangers in the newspaper. I came here to broaden my outlook. First, my kitten died. One morning he was lively and supple and warm in my hands. And when I came home from school, I picked him up all cold and stiff and hard, and ants were eating his eyes. That was hard for me. I've had pets die before, but I've never held them in my arms and thrown them down the garbage hole. And now to have Mabala die, that's so hard to bear. It makes me wonder how broad an outlook God wants me to have. Please, God, I don't want to be any broader. Are you listening? Now, the great tragedy, well, there's a lot of great tragedy here. One of them is that I tried after Karn's death, when I read this, to get a hold of Mabala's parents. And I failed. I couldn't find them. To have them, to tell them how much Karn loved Mabala. When Karn, well, first of all, I want to recommend the tape. It's probably one of the most remarkable tapes here in the library. And it's the one Fritz made 8-10 years ago, I guess, describing Susan's death and how they faced this. It's a remarkable, remarkable tape. And I was privileged to be invited to Fritz's home and to go through the last days of Susan, how she was brought home and the great time they had there, and they fixed up so she could and spend her last days with them at home. And it was a remarkable, remarkable time, and I think it was very fortunate I had that, because it did help me in times of great grief. I had counseled grieving people a lot, and I always said, boy, you got to carry on, you know. But when you lose one, it's pretty tough to carry on. I'll clue you in. I had commitments. I was on my way to a national meeting to speak. I did get there, and I spoke once or twice, and then turned around and went home from New York City to a grieving family. And then I had another commitment at an international meeting, very important assignments. And when I got there, I wasn't sure I could walk a block. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. Hardly anything, and it was terrible. But I've been telling all these people, you got to carry on, you know. I forgot to tell them they got to eat and sleep too. And when I got there, I finally got a hold of myself, and I says, you know, you can't, you got somebody to live for and a lot of things to do. And so I went to my hotel room and ordered up a meal and ate it. Didn't especially taste very good, but I ate it anyway. And I recalled, and it was, it's very important. I recall a meeting with Paul Tournier in 70 and then in 71, and talked over, you know, what do you say to a grieving person? And to all the questions I'd asked him up to this point, Paul Tournier is quite a famous psychiatrist, Christian psychiatrist in Geneva, Switzerland. Written a lot of great books, and some of them are here. Remarkable person. And I says, and I give him some cases. And all his questions, all the questions I'd asked him up to that point, I mean, he's very quick on the trigger, and often very humorous. But on this one, he didn't answer right away. And then he said, you must allow them to articulate their grief. And I remember that. And many times, people, especially couples, it's hard for them to articulate their grief to one another. In fact, the divorce rate following the loss of a child is very high, very high. Because they don't share in this grief, I think, and other reasons that Fritz can give you. Well, it was harder for my wife to articulate it, but I articulated it. Now, that isn't to mean that when you lose a child, I go up to you, articulate your grief, you know. Well, they're going to start crying, but you leave open. And there's one thing about it, many of you hearing that Fritz has lost a child and I have lost a child, you then are legitimate. Then people will come and talk to us about their loss. Because we've made it, up to this point at least. And it's very important for us to do that and for you to do that. And it's very important in the loss of a child. Some of you have mentioned compassionate friends, you know. We have sort of an informal compassionate friends in the People Pet Partnership at Pullman. When people have terminal animals, or our lost animals, to come and talk it over with us. And we put them in touch with people that have recently lost an animal. So they're legitimate then, and they can express their grief. It's very important. More and more now, we have professional people who are spending their time grief counseling people that have terminal animals or have lost animals. I have a cousin who's been a counselor. She was counseling in Spokane, and now she's back east. And her two biggest clientele were those with unresolved grief and those who had abortions. So this is part of the take-home lesson, I guess. And that we will listen and allow them to articulate their grief and to extend comfort, but also to carry on. Now with animals, I want to point out that not only dogs, there's some fantastic stories in dogs on how they grieve and in fact, like a dog of your neighbor, you know, or people separated from their animals die. I mentioned it to some of you with Sparky when this lady was denied continuation of keeping her dog in this nursing home and she had to part with it. She died soon after. Well, that's understandable. There have been surveys made of people and what place their animal had in their family. And in at least two surveys, 60 to 80% said that the animal was a member of their family. An associate of mine who is now a consultant to the Surgeon General of the Army for the human-animal bond. In fact, one of our veterinary students now, and he's done advanced work in social work, and he's a veterinarian, but he's the consultant, first time in the Army that they've had a consultant on the human-animal bond in the Army. And they have animals now in the soldier's home, in the airman's home, and at the hospital down in San Antonio, and they have a lot of interesting programs. What he did, a survey of people who, because a transient army population always moving, and sometimes they have to leave their dogs back. Like going to Hawaii, you got to pay $500 in, what is it, 4 months in quarantine. And he did a survey of that population. And 98.7% of them said the animal was a member of the family. And then when you ask them which member of the family, they say a child. And that's why it's so very difficult. for them. And it's, but it's not only in animals, in dogs. Other animals manifest this. For a loss of a close associate, I know of a sheep, for example, that had been spent its entire life with a horse. It got in there with a horse when it was quite old, and it was in there for many years with him, and the horse died, and they took the horse out, and the sheep went in the stanchion, or in the place where the horse always stayed, laid down and refused to leave and died there. Or when I was taking aquatic and marine medicine course in Woods Hole a few years ago, it's a neat course. It's one of the most remarkable courses I've ever had, and I'm the oldest person that ever took it. And we went in sort of night and day. And it was a very interesting course. And it's one of these courses where it's very expensive for them to put it on. And we only had 30 people in class, or 31. So you got a biography of everyone. You get a book with a biography of all the students. Well, when you get old, you also get wise. And you see, I didn't know much about the subject, so I went through the biographies, you see, and I picked out the person that knew the most about it. That was my lab partner. It was Pat. She had taught aquatic and marine medicine in universities in Canada. So she was my partner. And I got to know her quite well. I learned a lot about aquatic marine medicine from her. And she had she told me a very interesting story. Some years before, she met a fellow that had two gerbils, pet gerbils, two male gerbils. One of them was 4 and one of them was 6. But she married him anyway. And she became very fond of the gerbils. And they'd let them out at night. And gerbils are Mongolian rodents. Between a rat and a mouse. They're kind of neat. And they'd let these gerbils out to run in the living room and all. And then they'd say, well, it's time to get the gerbils in. Well, the gerbils picked up on this, you see. So they'd go and hide. They were together for quite a few years, about 3 years. They were married, and one day, one night, they had the gerbils out. And the more curious one of the group, when she had gone to the refrigerator and opened the refrigerator door, the curious gerbil jumped up on the ledge, and she didn't see it, and she closed the door on it and killed it. And the other gerbil refused feed and died in 2 days. So even it extends to them, you see. And I could give you similar stories for pigs. In elephants, it's awful. Elephants are awful, the grief. You know, they used to, you know, thin the herd. And they'd go down and shoot, you know, reduce the number. Well, it was so awful to see the wailing and the severe anxiety and distress manifested by these animals. So now, at least in many places, they take in sharpshooters that are very good. They study the herd and pick out the family, see, a given family. And then they assign you four, all five of us, you see, and we have our assignments so that within a very space of essentially seconds, you kill the family immediately. So you don't have this grieving. Of course, in primates, in non-human primates, some of those, it's really awful. And the mournful calls. I remember we had some gibbon apes when I was at the University of California. And one of them lost her baby. And it was awful to hear this articulation, but not in voice, you know, the sadness of this. And we had a lady come in from Southeast Asia, from Thailand. She was in the State Department, and she was very fond of gibbons. We had white-handed gibbons, and she had heard about them, and so she came up. She was in the States and came up to see them. And as she and we didn't tell her anything about them at that point, and as she was walking as she was walking towards the gibbon colony, she heard him, their vocalization. I used to be able to imitate it, but I won't try it tonight. And she says, one of your gibbons is mourning. And it was. You know, I mean, she detected it.
Hmm.
So you have this, and I could tell you a lot of stories about baboons and others that loosen offspring, and gray like goose, for example, a lot of geese, a lot of especially monogamous animals, the loss of a mate. And Conor Lorenz described this. You know, when one is lost, the other one calls, a mournful sort of call, and goes in ever broadening circles, looking, searching. And that's part of it, you know. Part of the grief process is you don't believe it, you deny it, you know. Did it really happen? It didn't happen, you see. And then this searching, and then anger sometimes, and many animals will express this anger, and people express this anger. They're angry, and I counsel our veterinary students, because many times the client will manifest great anger and blame you for causing the deaths when you were really trying to help and probably had nothing to do with it. But you don't return anger with anger, but with compassion, because that's part of the manifestation of the disease, sort of. This is what happens. And you hope that you can have a resolution to this. But if don't ever say that when somebody loses an animal, well, it was just a cat, or it was just a dog, you know. I don't want any of you ever to say that. And the other thing you don't allow them to say is, what if, you know. What if I wouldn't have left the gate open, you know. Or what if I would have done this, or brought it sooner, you know. That's self-flagellation, and it's all it is, it's destructive. You don't allow that to be said. And you don't say, we got another dog here for you could take home with you. It's just like if I lost my wife and say, you know, we got, I know a lady down the street.
Here's a replacement.
Yeah, here, we got one right ready for you.
See, it's a relationship that is the significant thing here, and the intensity of that relationship and the depth of it. And this can be, as Leo was saying earlier, just as deep in relationship to an animal as it is to another human. Now, sometimes inappropriately so, perhaps. That is
pathological.
Yeah, it can be pathological. But it's interesting, and I hear Leo talking about some of these relationships with animals and their grieving, to jump back into the human again, and we can learn so much from it. He mentioned that animals will sometimes show anger. Not only this great sense of loss and the searching and even denial, perhaps for a little while, but the anger that they will sometimes show, they will become almost dangerous because of their grief and because of it. But we do the same thing, don't we? If we have had the loss of a loved one, we'll start striking out. We'll blame the doctor for not having thought of the right medicine or whatever at the right time. Or Mary, of course, whopped it into Jesus one day, didn't she, on the same topic. If you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. I'm sure that was said sharply. And, you know, it wasn't said sweetly like we usually say it from the pulpit. Oh, if you'd only been here, he wouldn't have died. She was angry. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even during the anticipation of grief, during illnesses, we very often will become irritable and sometimes strike out at God. Well, we don't dare do that, huh? Maybe. I remember the time I had to do it and actually use the words of "damn you, God," in my furious anger. It was the night that we had to decide whether Sue was going to live or die. And that just made me furious. Now, I'd long since been through this thing that God doesn't cause cancer, goodness sakes, of all the rubbish that we put out on things like that. He reaches into our sorrow and into our grief to enfold us and to give us a big hug and again say, come to me, and sits with us. He did that to me when I shouted out my anger one night out under the stars. And when I had heard it enough from him that night, I walked back in the house and we decided that we wouldn't feed Sue anymore. No intravenous feedings, no more intrusion into the skin that had been punctured too many times over a period of a couple, 3 years. But it was done then in a setting of peace instead of... Because Sue had made something alive for us. And what she made alive for us was something that had become dead, or almost so in us. I don't suppose that there had been a Sunday, maybe ever in our lives, when we hadn't, together with other people, said that we believed in the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting. Amen. But it's one thing to say a thing like that, and another thing to live in a consciousness of eternity. And we've lost it, I think, as a generation of people. I think we've lost it as a church. How often do we hear much about eternity anymore? We're not living in a consciousness of eternity. This is what Karen was talking about when she said, here they die right in front of us. And she would like to have come back where she could escape that. Now really she wouldn't have. But this was out of the sorrow of that time and out of those moments, wishing she could escape it.